So welcome Akshat Dubey and Rakesh Mani, who are members of PwC's strategy consulting business. And today we're going to talk with them about the boom in craft liquors and how that affects the acquisition of smaller brands by bigger companies. So welcome, and it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So can you guys tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, in a very short thing, can you tell us a little bit about PwC's strategy consulting business and what you try to accomplish for your clients?
Yeah, so PwC has been sort of building their strategy business through acquisition for a number of years. Obviously, they got Bearing Point, and they acquired a bunch of other firms like PRTM, which was an ops-focused firm, Diamond, which was a technology-focused firm. And then it all sort of culminated when they acquired Booz & Company, which was a core sort of strategy consulting firm in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fairly large business right now. It's got, thousands of consultants sort of globally spread across multiple different geographies, countries, and all of that. And, it competes with the likes of, all the big names that you hear in the strategy consulting world.
Sure, Boston Consulting and all those guys.
Yeah. And in terms of what we do for our clients, I mean, we help them with, their biggest sort of questions and challenges. In some instances, it's about finding growth. In other instances, it's sort of, taking out costs. In instances, the growth could come through acquisitions, which is where I work and my colleague Rakesh also works. It could be organic growth. So it's a vast sort of, set of offerings that we serve our clients with.
Sure. So with that background, can you talk about the evolving consumer tastes that are driving demand for craft spirits? And I presume that means driving demand for acquisitions by large companies who want to quickly get into the craft spirits space.
Yeah, why don't I can get started with that, and then we can sort of chime in.
Sure.
So first of all, most importantly, what we're seeing across a bunch of different categories is the onset of the millennial and Generation Z, right, and how they're impacting choices across a bunch of different categories. Now, as they're growing in scale as a consumer group, they're implanting very distinct brand preferences that they find quote-unquote cool, right? So a lot of those things are around things being sustainable, experiential, and more personalized.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of industries, whether that's, consumer durables like razors, food, apparel, confectionery, what it's implied is a jettisoning of a lot of the old world brands that were revered by their parents and moving towards a set of brands and categories that are more in tune with how they perceive the world. And alcohol is no exception to that. Right?
Right.
So what you're seeing is a larger share of younger drinkers in the U.S. who are willing to pay a little bit more of a premium for brands that are a lot more fresh, right? They're imbued
mm-hmm.
with originality. They've got a unique identity. They've got a story behind them. There is a quote-unquote craft element to them, which carries a number of sort of pointers, right? So it's what is the history of the brand? How has it been made? How authentic is it? And so on. And a lot of this has come at the expense of the larger, more traditional brands.
Now, that in itself is not new in one respect, in that it seems like in my recollection of the evolution of this business over the last 40 years, that what has happened is that a new generation sort of rejects their parents' taste and goes off and gets into some new product. So we had at one point, we had in the beer space, we had Budweiser was the big brand, and then their kids came along and they all started drinking Miller Lite or Bud Light or something like that. And now their kids seem to be going toward Michelob Ultra as an example. But this is different because this is the craft spirit. This is the spirit space, not the beer space. And I don't think they've seen that quite to this extent, have they?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And, while I would characterize some of those moves in beer that you described as people moving from one brand to another, but they're largely brands of similar scale.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing here is a little bit different in that part of the entire charm of some of these new brands is that they're much smaller. They're often regional plays. They're much more authentic. They've got a story behind them. And part of the appeal is the rejection of a lot of that big spirits work. Right.
Right. So how does this now impact the large company, which has obviously got a problem on their hands?
Well, so first of all, a couple different things to sort of characterize the landscape a little bit. All of this is happening at a time when, firstly, you're seeing spirit gain much more share of throat among American consumers,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of that coming at the expense of beer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of reasons behind that. You know, firstly, it's perceived as a much more mature, sophisticated beverage. Secondly, so it's more suave. Secondly, there's also this perception that, you know, beer, by and large, has a lot more unhealthy connotations compared to spirits.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say those are some of the background context that under which this is happening.
Right.
Now, in terms of some of the larger players, there's a couple of things that they've been doing. One is a lot of them have been attempting innovation within their portfolios, right? So
right.
They're tapping into an existing brand heritage and trying to breathe life into it with new flavor innovations or launching a new premium iteration of it, right?
Right.
But a lot of these have seen limited success. So I think what we're seeing, you know, a lot of the M&A activity that's happening in the space is because a lot of the big players are realizing that they need brands with this craft halo in order to build more credibility with consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And accordingly, they've been looking for the right set of inorganic opportunities to go out and develop that.
But that does explain sort of where the large companies find themselves. And the problem they've had has been that, for instance, in the vodka space, I don't think that there is a flavor permutation left that somebody has not tried to put into the vodka market. So that type of innovation, I think you're right, just, you know, either has run its course or is not an effective way to deal with the issues they're trying to deal with right now.
Yeah. The other thing that I would add to that is I think the spirit, if you go back to the example of beer, right,
mm-hmm.
when craft beer became a little bit of a new thing, the argument goes that a lot of the big beer majors ignored that trend for a little too long. And today what you see is craft beer is about 12-13% of overall beer volumes.
Right.
Right. You know, by contrast, if you look at a lot of the spirits players, I think they've recognized the trend and the need to act on it a lot earlier than their cousins in the beer industry did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing the market developing a lot quicker. You're seeing acquirers moving more quickly and going out and targeting smaller and smaller targets.
Right. So what key question should a supplier ask before starting to target smaller targets, or what sort of things should a small craft distiller be thinking about if he hopes to sell to a large company?
In terms of some of the smaller companies, Joel, I think at the surface level, acquirers really need to focus on distilleries that, A, have a rich heritage and an identity, which can translate into a lot of those marketing cues that they're looking at, right, that they need. So originality, authenticity, so that they can differentiate from the big and old spirits brands that are more familiar names.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about what that means for craft distillers, I think that there's a couple of things there, right? So first of all, the most important thing is having a quality product, the quality of the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most important factor in determining the long-term success of a craft brand. So distillers need brand cachet, which is, you know, built by everyday perceptions of the consumers, and it's supported by critics' awards and industry competitions and things like that. Secondly, I think they need the right set of marketing capabilities, which
mm-hmm.
are essentially grassroots marketing capabilities. And that's something that they bring along with them in the context of an acquisition. A lot of the large, beverage alcohol players are not really necessarily very good at some of these grassroots marketing efforts. So I think some of those capabilities are also very important. You see some of these small craft spirits brands have been very successful in converting bartenders into ambassadors.
Right.
A lot of others have tapped into some of the interests of their particular demographic. So you've got digital ad campaigns around getting out the vote or, they partner with people like Spotify to create customized music lists to listen to while you're drinking their particular brand of spirits and so on.
Right.
And then you're also seeing, people creating very unique tasting experiences at their distilleries.
Which implies that they can't just be running a big factory. They need to be able to welcome customers in, let them meet the master distiller himself, see the kettle in which the magic is taking place and all of that sort of thing, and maybe be like the wine people and be having summer concerts out on the green if they can do that in where they're operating and so on, doesn't it?
That's right, because I think ultimately as a craft spirit, you're not just selling the product. You're also, encouraging consumers to buy into the culture around that product, which is small, which is authentic, which is, more open and things like that.
Right.
Yeah, I think, although I would add that, every company wants to be big, right? So it's not that, craft spirits don't want to sell more spirits. I think the secret sauce of this phenomena, the formula, is that you somehow need to sort of balance between size and scale and still sort of maintaining direct connection with your consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've been to like craft breweries, I've been to craft distilleries, which are producing fairly large volumes, right? But still you have sort of the tap room where you can go and you can, taste all the different brews that they have or the different sort of spirits they have. And when you talk to people there, they're telling you sort of the story behind each and every single flavor. And it's a funny story, how did accidentally this thing got prepared, it was a mistake, but then we tasted it and it tasted really good. So we started marketing it and so on and so forth. So it's a fun sort of atmosphere and connection that you're building with your consumers, right?
Right.
So it's really the balance between sort of being big and, doing volume, but at the same time making sure that you sort of maintain your connection with the consumers.
Okay, good. Akshat, thank you so much for that.
Just to give you a little bit of an anecdote to bring to life something like what Akshat is saying, right? You've got a lot of gin brands that sort of tout, the quality of their product and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, gin is a product that you and I, if we really wanted to, could go out and make in our own bathtubs.
Right.
But to share the example of one of these craft gin brands that recently got acquired, their entire marketing campaign and their story was around how they brought back copper stills to make gin. And it's an old technique that's been around 100 years, and they've sort of revived a lot of that, and that sort of, there's a lot of history behind those copper stills that they bought in, and there's a whole process around it, and it's a lot more authentic and credible and so on, and it influences the taste.
Right.
So what you see is that, part of the marketing effort and why consumers choose to drink this particular gin over something that's a lot more traditional, like a Bombay Sapphire or something, is to buy into a little bit of that story and that heritage.
Sure. And that makes perfect sense. And I think I agree with you that it certainly reflects the building of that personal connection between the customer and the people that make the product.
Yeah, and sort of continuing on what Rakesh was saying earlier, right? So one of the other things which is extremely important is just sort of the pure quality of the product, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of having the right assortment and so on and so forth. So, I mean, unlikely that as a, beverage company, whether you're selling beers or alcohol, it's very unlikely that you're only selling one product, right?
Right.
You need to have sort of an assortment of products that, can cater to the different tastes of the consumers or different moods of the consumers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of the challenge with, you know, craft spirits and craft beers getting so much traction and so much growth is that the current sort of playing field is a bit of a mixed bag of, you know, really good companies and some that are not so good, right? So from the point of view of just making sure that your product is really solid and it's not just because your growth is not just coming from the fact that, you know, craft as a phenomenon is growing, right?
Right.
It's really got its own legs. That's another very important thing. And that also plays a very, fairly important part in sort of the second part of your question, Joel, which was, you know, what should some of these large players look for, right, in sort of the smaller companies that they're looking at bringing on board?
Good. And I suppose product mix makes a difference too, doesn't it?
Yeah, as I said, right? I mean, it's really important that you have a fairly sort of broad assortment. So if you look at like successful sort of craft breweries or beer companies, you typically see that they have 8 to 10, 15 sometimes sort of, you know, regular mm-hmm. flavors. They usually do a lot of seasonals and so on and so forth. Similarly, on the spirit side, we see, you know, companies which are doing sort of, you know, multiple different sort of flavors of bourbons, and, you know, you'll typically see that, you know, companies are also producing brown spirits along with some sort of white spirits and so on and so forth, just to have a balanced portfolio and sort of make sure that, you know, you can take care of sort of the seasonality and some of those things which are involved with, you know, both the production and consumption of some of these spirits.
Right, absolutely so, because obviously, well, not obviously, but a lot of people don't particularly want to drink a bourbon necessarily in the winter, in the summertime, but they certainly want to have it in the winter and vice versa and so on.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think it also impacts a little bit the scalability of a lot of these distilleries, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a small minority that sort of, you know, source some of their liquid and then put it through a process.
Right.
So maybe they're not subject to the same constraints. But if you're aging your own bourbon and you're going through that process from scratch, there's a little bit of a supply constraint in how quickly you can scale up.
Right.
So, you know, for a lot of these guys, it becomes a little bit important to say, you know, well, we do brown spirits, and that's our sort of our core business. We do a great bourbon, and it's aged 5, 7, 10 years, what have you. But then we've also got a range of clear spirits where the volume can be pumped up a little bit more easily. And secondly, I think it also allows you to cater to a wider range of consumer occasions and taste profiles, so seasonality being one example. But at the same time, you know, there's different occasions where you might prefer, say, a sip drink versus a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing is the cocktail culture is really having a bit of a renaissance in the States now.
Right. And all of that talks to the question about production capabilities, which means that a new distillery probably is not going to be a good target for a large company, simply because they don't have enough capability on their own to do this. And if they, you know, one of the beer companies caught a lot of flack when they bought one of the small craft brewers and immediately took them into their huge, you know, beer manufacturing process, and at least among the craft space people, they sort of thought that at that point they'd lost the magic of the craft brewing thing. And I would assume the same thing could happen to the spirits guys, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I think that leads a little bit into the last question you asked, right? That
mm-hmm.
how should a larger company help manage and grow one of these smaller distilleries?
Right.
And I think the primary consideration there is to maintain the credibility of the original craft brand, right? So what you see is a lot of acquirers essentially let a craft beer run a little bit independently after an acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And where they help is a little bit more on the outside with, you know, distribution benefits and some capital for brand support and marketing.
Right.
And this could mean that, you know, the distiller's founder or CEO stays on board, the acquirer minimizes their intervention in day-to-day operations, and they try and keep the process as untainted as possible. But at the same time, we think a large acquirer can also provide some other capabilities selectively, especially in areas where scale offers benefits, right? So whether that's ensuring the stability of some of the raw material supply, driving down the price of ingredients, giving access to their marketing agencies and distributor network and things like that.
Which could be a real plus for a smaller company. I can certainly understand that. That could be really important and help them grow. And in fact, I've heard some of the people who've been acquired in recent months talk about, how they're looking forward to being able to just distill and not have to worry about beating bank loan deadlines or, supply of grain evaporating on them because of bad weather or something like that. And you're certainly right. A large company has the capability to step in and really help in those sort of situations.
Yeah.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And that's something that you see on the craft beer side as well. A lot of the really small guys have a little bit of a challenging time with some of these basic things, right?
Right.
And for their part, they're still trying to sort of hunt and win shelf space and scale their operations. But the reality is only a few of the craft outfits have the ability to do this at any scale independently,
mm-hmm.
given the amount of investments that are needed. So what you see is that of all the 1,300-odd craft distillers in the state, more than 90% produce fewer than 50,000 9-liter cases in a year.
Right.
The top 2% actually account for more than 50% of all craft spirits volumes.
Now, that's a fascinating statistic, which I guess I knew, but I'd never heard it expressed quite that way. And it certainly speaks to, and I would assume that a large company, a Brown-Forman or a Diageo or somebody like that, would be looking probably to acquire the companies in that top 2% category, or would they be looking for the smaller guys who are really struggling? What do you think?
So I think historically, if you look at sort of the craft beer side, right?
Uh-huh.
I feel that some of the breweries, some of the larger breweries, right, like the traditional ones, like TPI and Tab Miller and all, they kind of felt that, they lost out a little bit on this phenomena by not jumping in faster or sooner, right?
Right.
And because of which, obviously there were multiple impacts, right? So one, there were a lot of like independent craft breweries that were able to establish themselves. And then whichever assets got traded on later, they went for a very, very high multiple, right? So the acquisition cost was pretty significant. I do feel that based on that, we are seeing on sort of the spirit side, at least, that, some of the larger companies are trying to take a part in this game much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they're going for slightly smaller assets, right? I mean, they're not going for really small sort of distillery, which is only catering to sort of, a city or a neighborhood or something like that.
Right.
But they are going for things which are more sort of regionally oriented. And, so for example, if you go and ask like people in the beer industry, they would say that, they would never look at a craft brewery till that brewery goes and establishes like a couple of breweries around the country, right? So they say that, if it's only one single brewery, then, you could be, it could be that, you were lucky and you just found some consumers there who really like your products.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to make sure that, there's broader appeal for your product in the nation.
Right.
On the spirit side, I don't think we are seeing that, right? Some of these, if you look at some of the recent acquisitions that have happened, they're all fairly small companies, regional kind of companies, and they've got great products. But, it's still that, the large spirit company is taking a little bit of a risk by acquiring them with the promise that they can really grow them sort of nationally or internationally in some instances. But again, on the flip side, they're buying it for a cheaper sort of premium or price, right, comparatively. And
right.
If they are successful, the returns can be pretty significant.
Sure.
Yeah, you can go a little bit lower down the pecking order in terms of size, but ultimately, if you're a larger player, you need an acquisition that's going to move the needle for you in some measure.
Right.
I think what becomes really important with a lot of the smaller acquisitions is how much production capacity or unused production capacity is available. And that really determines the near-term growth potential and has a big impact on the valuation, right? But also, what is the ability of the existing infrastructure to support expansion also determines that, maybe a little bit more medium-term, but if I go out and buy Distillery X that's not in that top 2%, to what extent can I scale it up in the near term, and how much can I scale it up in the medium term if I put in the right investments?
And that makes total sense to me, but I hadn't thought about that, and that's why you're in your business and I'm in my business, I guess. But that makes total sense, and it certainly suggests that the small guy as well as the big guy has to have carefully thought through their strategy. A small distiller can't afford really to be just operating out of his garage, if you will. He really needs to have some area in which he can expand his production facility if he's going to have a good shot at being acquired, if that's where he wants to go as part of his exit strategy.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Good. Well, we've covered my questions, but I'm wondering if there's a question or two that you wish I would have asked that I didn't ask, and if so, would you tell me what those are and what your answers would be?
So I've got a big one.
Okay.
Which is, what is the potential upside here, and how big is this market, and how quickly do we expect it to grow?
Good question, and what's the answer?
So the answer to that is, if you look at the most recent year, craft distillers in the U.S. sold about 5 million 9-liter cases of spirit,
mm-hmm.
right? By 2020, the expectation is that volumes will grow about 5x to 25 million cases, right?
Oh, boy.
So that is the extent of growth that the market is expecting. To give you a little bit of another anecdote, right, another set of statistics, there's about 1,300 craft distillers in the U.S. today,
mm-hmm.
and together they hold about, little over 2% volume share of the overall spirits market.
Right.
Now, just 5 years ago, that number was below 1%. It was 0.8%.
Right.
Right? And it's grown to 2.2% today. Now, if you compare that with craft beer today, it's about 13% of the overall beer market. So if you believe that craft spirits is going to behave anything like craft beer, if a lot of the factors that are driving people to go out and drink a craft beer versus, say, a Budweiser hold in the spirits market, and from everything that we see, it is true, if not even more pronounced, the potential upside here is for that share to go from 2% anywhere up to 12 or 13%.
Up to 10 to 12%, did you say?
Yeah, another 10 percentage points of share within their category.
And that would be a tremendous game changer, not only for the craft distillers, but also for the large companies, which would explain why they really do need to be focusing on this issue quickly and early.
That's right.
Yeah. Any other big questions that I didn't ask that I should have?
The only other thing that I would add is that, so if you think about a lot of the categories within spirits that have been beneficiaries of this renaissance,
mm-hmm.
We've already talked about how you've seen a lot of this in brown spirits as well as clear spirits,
right?
But I think there's some categories that have probably led a lot of this growth. So bourbon, tequila, gin. And there's some others that have been a little bit slower to build that traction. So rum, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look at all the craft spirits labels out there today, almost one-third of those labels are whiskeys of some sort.
True.
Right?
True.
And then you've got gins and vodkas.
Right.
But the question is, what we also expect is a lot of those categories that have been a little bit slower up that curve, if you will,
mm-hmm.
are going to see their tipping point soon enough. So you're, for example, with rum, you're already seeing a lot of that with, you know, a raft of new flavored rums and spiced rums and sipping rums, and there's a lot more premiumization happening there.
Right.
So we expect a lot of that to pick up.
Good. Good. Excellent. Well, Rakesh Mani and Akshat Dubey, it's been so good talking to you. If somebody wants to talk to you further and perhaps explore things they're thinking about, how should they get a hold of one of you guys?
I mean, I think our article has sort of our contact information and things like that. And, you know, it's, yeah, that's probably the best way of reaching out to us.
Which is by email?
Yeah.
And what is your email address?
It is basically, it's firstname.lastname@pwc.com.
So that would be, for instance, rakesh.mani@pwc.com and akshat.dubey@pwc.com, right?
That's right.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. If you'll stand by for one moment, we do have one thing we need to talk offline about. But thank you so much, and we really appreciate it. And, you know, we're looking forward to talking with you in about a year and seeing how the category is continuing to evolve. So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you hopefully in a year.